Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
Thanks for coming back to the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. It is August, which means we are talking about how recruiting works, and we are doing so today with UMass head coach Kyle Smith. Coach Smith, thank you so much for joining. How are you doing?
Good. How are you, Terry? Thanks for having me.
I'm great. This is the best time of year for a variety of reasons. But one of them is this is kind of harvest season, right? You know, you've spent all June and July on the sidelines watching, and now you get to turn all that work into lists. And for all of us, that comes with a varying degree of fun and enjoyment. But with that being said, you also get to have these conversations with folks like yourself. And I think that I'm really fired up for this conversation for a couple of reasons. But one of them is just because I think recruiting to UMass is particularly unique, and we're going to get into that. But before we do, I want to start in the same place that all these conversations start, which is, how do you describe the way that you evaluate?
Ooh, good question. Well, it's really a pretty big process overall, right? It is going out and seeing the guys first off. You know, you got to lay eyes on them. You got to be able to see how they interact with teammates, with coaches, how they move in person, size, speed, athleticism, skill, all those things, IQ. But then it really kind of transforms into what does their coaches say about him? Is there anybody that we know who is close to him, who's been in the same area, county, region, school, high school coach, club coach? So we dive pretty deep on them. And then, you know, in the end, the hope is to get them to campus. And that's a big part of this, too, is, you know, how we interact with the prospective student athlete, but also the parents. You know, you said June and July. I think with the 28 class and the way that this works is we were watching them in November and December as well. So, you know, we've been at this for a while. Right now, what we do as a staff is, and this has really been an ongoing conversation, you know, you're always recruiting over the course of the last 8 months, really, for this class. But we sit down, we divvy up the club coaches, high school coaches. We try to talk to as many as we can. And then we have a couple meetings on really, you know, who we're going after. And with this year it being pushed back a little bit, it's kind of good. We got a little bit more time to kind of have those conversations.
It's interesting that you bring up November and December, because when the rules changed in 2017, the job of recruiting went from managing, you know, your own roster on campus to an entire roster of committed players that were currently playing in high school, right? Like, there were some programs that were managing 8 years of a team. And it really felt like, because the change was so sudden, the reaction was so dramatic, and it was basically to shrink from focusing on four classes to focusing on one. And I felt like that remained pretty much the case. And I felt like basically up to about a year ago. And for me, one of the things that I would like jokingly criticize your peers about was, you're forfeiting an opportunity to add another evaluative criteria to what you look at, which is rate of improvement, right? Like, if you decide that you're only going to watch kids in the summer before their rising junior year, then not only are you missing the kids that aren't playing because they're injured, you're also not accounting for, you know, guys who were really good early and then plateaued, and then other guys who were nowhere on the radar and then rocketed up in terms of, you know, how much better they got over the course of their high school summer or their high school season or that summer. And I would imagine that rate of improvement is a useful criteria. But with that being said, I felt like last year was a reflection of what had actually changed on the ground, which was, it was the second year of a really fast rate of commitment, where most programs or many programs had the majority of their class filled by October 31st in terms of the commitments that they'd received from the juniors. And what that meant was, you're going to spend a lot of November watching those kids that commit, you know, just having the opportunity to interact with them on a field kind of like for the first time. to the extent that you're able to, and then subsequently have available bandwidth to start watching the younger grad year, and then add that additional season to it. Long question, how do you describe the way that matches your experience? And then the second part of the question is, how do you regard the high school season? Because, you know, Amherst, Massachusetts isn't necessarily the most convenient place to get out to a ton of high school games, but it's more convenient than a lot, in addition to which the preponderance of being able to stream, watch streams has increased as well. So two-part question, is my reason for why watching 28s last fall became more realistic, like a fair explanation? And the second is, how do you regard the high school spring season?
Yeah, you're exactly right. We have been done with our class probably the last at least two, three recruiting cycles where we've been done by Halloween. And we fight that all the time. We would like the process to be slower. But, you know, we probably from September 1st on, we bring up somewhere between 30 and 40 guys. So it's kind of a sprint for us right out of the gate. And you know, a lot of these guys are strong kids, strong students, strong athletes from great families, great kids. And it's, you know, it seems to be a really good fit on a lot of levels. And so you got to go with that. And you're right. You know, the rate of improvement, we don't get to see it as much. And it's, you know, so that's something that I think the five-year rule, it changes a little bit, that we're going to be a little bit slower with this class just because we're taking so few guys. Our class is shrinking a little bit, and so it gives us a little bit more room to continue to watch that recruiting age in the fall here and kind of see where we're at. And then, you know, the other piece of that is, you know, we're lucky. We have Chris Gabrielli on staff. Gabs, his folks are still in Long Island. He will go down the minute our season is done, and he just watches Long Island, bounces around, gets to some prep schools that are in that area, you know, all that. Us in New England, being UMass, I would say predominantly we're Massachusetts, a lot of Long Island. But pretty much a four-hour radius around makes up probably 75-80% of any one of our teams. So we're able to jet off whenever the season's done and watch guys. But you really follow from a distance. You try to keep up to date on scores, talk to your high school coaches that are good resources for you, and really just get a vibe of how it's going, individual players, what teams are having strong seasons. You know, you really rely on the club guys and the high school guys for that, because when we're in season, it's really hard to do anything else other than focus on what you are doing and your responsibilities to the team.
Not surprising, because I asked such a long question, but that answer contained so many little threads that I want to follow up on. But the first is, you mentioned that you'll probably bring about 30 to 40, in this case, 28s to campus in order to get the group of players that ultimately comprise your class. About how many outreaches will you make in order to get to that number of visits?
That's a good question. I would say that's been the standard in the past. We'll probably, that number will be smaller this year. I think any, you know, there's certainly an email correspondence. There's a text, there's phone calls. I would say anywhere between 70 and 100 right off the bat. And we probably get around 30 to 40 of those to campus. And then we kind of go from there with it.
How do you describe, you know, a visit?
You know, well, the first thing they do, they come in, they'll sit down with me. We'll get, you know, sometimes it's for 20 minutes. Other times, you know, the conversation goes, it's 45 minutes. We just talk. I try to push it onto the student athlete as much as possible. You know, open up, tell me what you think about everything, right? Your family. What do you like to do? Hobbies? You know, try to keep it away from lacrosse as much as possible in the beginning, and then you know, obviously filter in lacrosse as it goes. But then there will be, you know, after that initial meeting, there'll then be a tour. They tour a facility, field. You know, we walk them around residential dormitories, take them to campus, bring them up to the campus center where, you know, they get a really good overview of the Pioneer Valley campus. It can really shrink campus for them when they're up there, right? Getting a bird's eye view of things. So all in all, if a kid comes in and it's 10 a.m., you know, he'll usually finish with a practice, something like that, and then another meeting at the end. We try to make it a full day thing where we just immerse them in the school, UMass lacrosse, as much as possible. We always try to fit in a time where they go off with the guys on their own for a couple hours so they can get a vibe of the guys that are on the team and kind of what their day looks like and be able to form some form of relationship. We always encourage them to ask questions. So, you know, it's a lot. You know, I think most of these prospective student athletes leave pretty tired. You know, it's kind of a whirlwind of a day. They're meeting people, they're walking, they're talking. We want them to answer questions on their own. And then, you know, it's also a really good opportunity for us to get to know the parents and get to know where these students come from. And so, you know, for us, it's really a very important part of the process is the on-campus visit.
You mentioned geography, and it is one of the things that makes UMass a little bit unique. The function of being a flagship state university, you know, having 1A football, but not being a Power Four, while also, you know, being distinctive in terms of the combination of the quality of lacrosse that's played in your state, be it public or private, as well as the strong identity that you have to Long Island. How do you describe the geography that both makes up your program from a DNA standpoint and from a just kind of how it's gone, right? Like what it means and what you attribute it to.
Yeah. I grew up around the program. So, I grew up 40 minutes away. My dad played here. My grandpa had been involved in the program, was good friends with Coach Garber since the 50s. So, you know, the amount of New England, Massachusetts specifically, and Long Island, players that have come through here. I mean, you can look at a roster from 1986 and it's all Mass and it's all Long Island right now. Lacrosse has grown, and so, you know, a couple years ago Trace Hogan was from Florida and he was our leading scorer, right? You know, we had Grant Brow, who's a great two-way middie, he was from Georgia. So you know, we pull guys from everywhere now, but you know, Massachusetts and Long Island, that's kind of just been a real identity for us over the years. You know, I mean, there's probably enough cliches. Those are edge guys. Those are competitive guys. Those are tough guys. And so you get enough of them in the locker room, and it, you know, there can be a really strong culture of toughness, work ethic, and you hope some talent too.
You mentioned bringing in a smaller class. One of the things that I'm not sure everybody realizes, but I remember talking to Coach Canella about a long time ago, is you have a roster limit that's below 48, or at least have had. And so as a result, like the math of the fifth year is a little different from maybe what some of the folks, you know, kind of perceive or think about. And with that being said, it's not a question about the class composition numbers wise. It's more a question about how men's lacrosse fits into the broader UMass athletic department and ecosystem. What's that like, and how do you describe the role that you guys play within the department?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, like you said, we have 1A football, and football rules the day here. We also have a really strong basketball program, and then hockey. Hockey has had it rolling here for the last probably decade with Coach Carville. So we're probably in a tier right below them. You know, hockey is a big deal in Hockey East, New England. So that is a big priority for our athletic department. And then, of course, the football and basketballs of the world. I would say men's lacrosse is certainly a big priority. It's heavily supported by our athletic department and by our alums. We have a very special group of alums, whether it is, they help through obviously donations. We're getting Greg Rushing, Kelly Carr, these guys are getting a scholarship endowment set up for us, named after Coach Cannella. So, their effort and their impact demands respect as well. So, we have a really good setup here in our athletic department. We work with great people. Ryan Bamford's done an excellent job with, the steady, consistent help that he has provided over the last decade that he has been here has been really good for us. And frankly, it's pretty necessary in this day and age too. So I give them a lot of credit for being able to recognize that and doing what they need to do to help us out and help us stay competitive.
How has the transition from the CAA into the Atlantic 10 affected the program?
Well, I would say in the CAA, there was some schools that were maybe a little more similar to us over the years, right? The Towsons, well, Delaware's in the A-10 now. Hofstra, we had always played Hofstra. We might have been, and then we go into the A-10 where it's a lot of small private schools and we're kind of the big state school outlier, so to speak. And now Delaware coming in, that's a little bit more like a UMass. But the A-10 is competitive as hell, honestly. It's great conference. Every program's really good, well-coached, tremendous in recruiting, tremendous facilities. It's really a very impressive conference that, I think it gets the respect it deserves, right? I think, everybody that I talk to is like, wow, the A-10 is really good. It's a part of the reason we all choose this profession, right? It's a competitive situation. And, we like the A-10. The A-10 is a really good conference for us.
There are two elements of your experience that I want to dive into. You mentioned you're an alum, and what was your recruitment like? How do you describe it? Given the fact that you had been around the program and been so familiar with it, but at the same time, in my experience and conversations with folks kind of in this ilk or, who had a similar type of experience, it's usually not a fait accompli, right? Like you at least have to survey the field and figure out whether there's something else out there for you. And not only that, but you also have to prove that you're worthy of an opportunity to play at a place like UMass. How do you describe your own recruitment?
Yeah, Coach Cannella always called it. He would tell me we got Smith for a song and a dance. I would say that my dad, my dad was a special guy, and so he really wanted me to come to UMass. I've really wanted to come to UMass too. I grew up around it. I had a different insight onto Coach Cannella and the program and the people behind it and in it. And it was just a special place. That much was obvious. I think my parents did a good job of making sure it was, we took visits, we went other places. I remember taking visits for football as well. They wanted this to feel like it was my decision and it was open. And if I'm being totally honest, I don't know how open it really was, but they at least gave me the illusion that it was open. And so that was definitely important for me because in the end, it was one of the best decisions of my entire life was taking up Coach Cannella on the offer.
And that's a natural and perfect segue into the second element of your experience that I want to dive into, which is you took over as head coach from Coach Cannella last summer. How do you describe that transition broadly and then specifically around what it meant with respect to your role in recruiting?
The transition, I think it went pretty smooth. I was in a situation where I was on staff and I had my own relationship with these players and I was part of their recruiting process. And so, I was a consistent person in their lives. And so I think that they, you know, I'll give the last year's team a lot of credit. They were super responsive, very respectful, genuinely excited for me. And so that made the transition that much easier. I wasn't meeting people for the first time. You know, and that's a credit to Coach Cannella, and really what he built. I think, you know, the way recruiting might have changed, I don't really know. It's still recruiting. Coach Cannella did a really good job of empowering assistants, trying to build you into being a head coach. And so he would really push you forward. And if you had a recruit and you went through the process, then pull the trigger, Kyle, right? So, you know, he was really great, a great mentor for me in that aspect, where last fall didn't feel like I was doing anything different. I probably was just on the phone a bit more. I probably did a couple less visits, but, you know, that was pretty much really the only changes.
That's really interesting, and I want to dive in there a little bit because, you know, I know that there are staffs that kind of, you know, structure it in a way where it's the assistant's responsibility to, by and large, you know, create the broad group of prospective targets. You know, we think this guy can play for us, and we think we can get him. And then, you know, once contact starts, September 1st, whatever, you know, develop the relationship, right? Start to, you know, tell the story in a way where you figure out whether both parties are like, yeah, this is the right fit for me. And then ultimately, it's the head coach's responsibility to close, so to speak. And you know, get that final commitment, and then I know that there are some staffs where it becomes a game in terms of the way that he communicates it with the assistants that, you know, kind of put the ball on the tee, so to speak. So it's really interesting to kind of hear you frame it the way that you just did in terms of what your experience was and how it positioned you in order to smoothly transition into the role. But how do you describe the way that it's structured now with your assistants in terms of, you know, obviously you mentioned Coach Gabrielli, and certainly he's got a ton of experience, you know, both by being a head coach, also, you know, well-regarded as a defensive mind, so to speak. But then with respect to the rest of the assistant group, how do they delineate responsibilities there? And how does that all kind of flow up into how you've, you know, tried to form a role for yourself that might be a little distinct from what Coach Cannella did or might not be distinct at all?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I would say it changes. It depends on the position, depends on the recruit. It depends, you know, if we feel like we need to get two guys on it, then we'll get two guys on it. You know, I would say that I probably handle more of the end of the recruiting process than everybody on staff, but it's really an all hands on deck approach. Because, like I mentioned earlier, it is such a sprint. And when the last couple of years, you're done with a class in 2 months, all of these aren't going to be cookie cutter, right? Some kids might be at the end of their visits, other kids might just be starting their visits, and it's going to be a longer thing for them. Some guys might have one school in mind, and you might be hanging back a little bit. Some kids want to commit right after their visit. So, you know, we kind of take this thing all in stride. That's probably when our group chat is the most alive, is September 1st, Halloween, because everyone's getting on the same page and stuff's pretty fluid. So, you know, I tend to handle more of the end of it, but it's really all hands on deck.
You just brought up something that I want to dive a little deeper on, which is the distinction between somebody for whom UMass is their number one or their dream school, you know, versus, you know, it might not be the first option. How do you regard the way in which you invest time into those two distinct profiles?
It's a good question. You know, ultimately, we want guys who want to be at UMass. You know, if we feel like we have to really convince them and sell them, you know, then it comes to a point where it's just not worth it. And maybe down the line, this is not going to work out. But people who want to commit for the right reasons, because it's a terrific school in one of the best college towns in the country, and you get to play for one of the more historic programs, and somebody wants in on that and has kind of zeroed in on us, we feel like the development from that commitment to when they are a junior and senior and eventually a leader for us is going to be dramatic, because they're going to really like where they are. They're going to feel comfortable, and they know they made that decision for the right reasons. And so that's really an important part of this whole process that we value tremendously.
You mentioned the history, and you know, for me, the 2006 team is one of the more iconic teams of my lacrosse life, so to speak. But I'm 42. I'm closer to the dads of the recruits that are walking through the door than I am the players themselves. And then obviously there have been, you know, tremendous teams before and since. How do you feel like the typical prospective student athlete understands UMass lacrosse history?
We've been very fortunate that over, you know, it's going to be, I think, 73 years now, we've only had four head coaches. It was Dick Garber for 36. It was Ted for four, his son. It was Coach Canella for 31. And he obviously coached with Ted Garber and then played for Coach Garber. And then, you know, now I'm here. Coach Gabrielli's here, you know. So, you know, when we played for Coach Canella, my dad played for Coach Garber. So, you know, like when you tell prospective student athletes that, all of a sudden it starts to bring to life, like, this place is incredibly consistent. There must be something special about this place, right? So, you know, I think we try to convey that it's the people, it's the relationships built here. It's the network. It's being able to get mentored by somebody who was once in your shoes here not too long ago. You know, I can't speak more highly of our alumni network and kind of what they provide and the passion that they provide.
We've kind of like circled around a lot of the combination of, you know, profile of who's interested or who is of interest to UMass typically, as well as kind of the value prop for, you know, why it becomes the best fit for guys within that profile. But you mentioned something before I press record that I wanted to dig in on a little bit, and it, you know, shoulders off of the conversation about being a state flagship institution. Last week, we talked to North Carolina head coach Joe Bresci, and he talked about the state's decision to reclassify all athletes as in-state for scholarship and tuition purposes, and what that's meant for effectively, you know, tripling or more the volume of scholarships that they have access to, because it, you know, in a non-scholarship limit environment, whereby their budget is still what it previously was, that's effectively what happened. I understand similar conversations are, you know, potentially on the table in the state of Massachusetts. What would that mean for your program?
That would mean a lot. You know, and I've heard that there have been talks about that. I know North Carolina, you just mentioned, I think also Maryland. I don't know. You know, I know some state schools have gone that road. So, you know, that would be huge for us, because our scholarship budget wouldn't change. And like you said, you know, scholarships would multiply. So, you know, for us, just with the, equivalencies being wiped away, it allowed us to be much more competitive, in state and not be beholden to the 12.6 scholarships. So, you know, that change had a big impact on us. But this would be dramatic, because it would include everybody. So, you know, and it would affect other things, right? Our out-of-state guys get academic merit money if they're at a level academically. So, you know, that would probably change. But, you know, in-state, I think our tuition's right around 20, and all-in might be around 35. So that's still holding pretty true to incredibly low compared to other schools. So, you know, that would be a game changer for us.
Did you, said that it was a significant changer in terms of the conversations that you were able to have with respect to, you know, in a post equivalency world. Did it manifest in terms of the composition of the class that you committed?
It did. We started going a little bit more in state, again, more so than usual, I would say. But also, it allowed us to be in the ballpark with some higher end recruits, that maybe we couldn't compete with because of equivalency and money before that. And so, you know, it at least got those guys to campus to be able to show them what the University of Massachusetts has to offer.
And that has tremendous downstream benefits. If it doesn't end up with a commitment from, you know, that individual, then certainly the word of mouth when he goes back to his teams, high school and club, and you know, talks about his experience, very rarely is that a bad thing.
But it
is also, you know, kind of a teeing up for a good note to end on here, which is, you know, and I want to be open-ended because, you know, there's so many different pathways that you could take this. But between the fact that, you know, while I understand that because you're familiar with the program is effectively lifelong, it doesn't necessarily feel like year two as head coach, but it is. And then that combined with all of the changes going on within college athletics equals a little bit of green grass in terms of what the future holds. So let me just put it to you, like where do you see this thing going, both for your program specifically and for men's lacrosse generally?
I think with the rule changes, we're positioned pretty well, because, you know, We like a lot of the guys, the individuals in our program right now. We feel like we have great kids, great leaders, great players that it's like, you know, we would love to have these guys back and be able to retain them. And so I look at it as the ultimate benefit where a lot of these guys played together last year. And now they get to do it again and potentially again. And you don't usually get that in college athletics. That seems to be more of a professional style window where the brotherhood just continues to grow and grow and grow and the chemistry grows. And so, you know, we're excited. It's just like any other year. It's all about the work. It's all about the process. We're going right to it. You know, Labor Day will be our first meeting, and then we'll go from there. But we're excited about the future. The guys are too. Every time we talk, just the prospect that the potential to have more time together when this, you never get gifted that. Where you know you can bring everybody back or as many as you can for an additional year is pretty special. And so I think the guys realize that. And, you know, because they're such good kids, we feel like the timing couldn't be more perfect for UMass lacrosse in that aspect. And then where it goes from here, don't know. This is a day-to-day, season-to-season thing. The fall season's its own thing, and then the winter comes, and then you got preseason. And you know, the season itself, for us, that's a marathon. Recruiting in the summer, that brings its own different dynamics. But right now, I'm just looking forward to the fall. You know, there's nothing like being with your team every day and just purely focused on getting bigger, stronger, faster, and better and more connected.
Great note to end on. Kyle Smith, really appreciate your time on the Inside Lacrosse podcast. Enjoy getting everybody back on campus. Good luck when September 9th hits. Can't wait to see what type of class the Minutemen put together, and can't wait to see what team you put on the field this fall and next spring. Can't wait to watch UMass get back into action.
Thank you, Terry. Appreciate you.
Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.